Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The 1986 hit single, How Will I Know, includes a 40-second instrumental before singer Whitney Houston joins in. We don't have time to listen to that instrumental today. Just take my word for it. Lengthy intros were common back then, but the technology of streaming services has changed the imperatives for song lists. And a new study shows that that technology has affected how we listen to music and how that might be changing the makeup of popular music. Joining us now is author of the study and doctoral student in music theory at Ohio State University, Hubert Lavalle-Govan. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Anne.
You analyzed top 10 singles from 1986 to 2015 for this project. Did you have any idea what you'd find before you started?
A little bit. So we had some predictions. The whole project came from a paper from Wired magazine from 1997 by Michael Goldhaber. And in this paper, he talks about what he calls the attention economy. And so remember, this is the late 1990s, but he's predicting that since attention is both scarce and valuable, it is going to become the currency of the information age. And what I thought was shocking about this paper is how accurate his prediction was. So I'm a music theory student. This is what I mostly think about. And I thought, wow, I mean, this all makes so much sense for something like Spotify, where people don't really make money out of it. But if you think that attention is a currency, then it makes a lot of sense for people to put their music on a streaming service like that. So I started to think, okay, well, if we think that attention is a currency, what predictions should we have on the way that music has changed in the last 15 years or so? And there are two things. Once attention becomes so valuable, we should expect that the number of things trying to grab your attention increases. And that's exactly what we've seen. I mean, in the last 10 years or so with YouTube and Apple Music and Pandora and Spotify, the number of songs available for instant listening has never been that big. So that matches the theory. The number of songs available has been increasing steadily in the last 15 years or so. The second thing we should be expecting is that if attention is so valuable, we should expect that people, either consciously or not, adapt the way they compose music to grab your attention. And that was the premise behind this project.
Why can't grabbing attention involve a longer introduction, instrumental introduction?
So one of the things we know is that the voice is one of the most attention-grabbing thing there is. We know this from, among other things, study on publicity. So we know that advertisement featuring instrumental vocal music is more effective than advertisement featuring instrumental music. And we also know this from research done by Muzak. So the Muzak Corporation, they created music for the workplace. And their idea was, how can we increase arousal or productivity without catching people's attention? So basically, we want to increase people's productivity without them being distracted by the music. And Muzak is famous for creating those, like, a bit cheesy version of the Beatles songs where the melody is replaced by a trombone or something like that. But because that's what they were going for. They were going for a way that people would have music to listen to that would not be too distracting. And one of the first things that Muzak would do is to get rid of the voice, because this is one of the
lyrics.
So they'd have some instrumental version of the songs. So based on the work from Muzak, it would make sense that one of the most attention-grabbing thing is the voice of an artist, right? That's something that we remember, and we're pretty good at telling, oh, this is, I don't know, Sheryl Crow, and this is Taylor Swift, and based on their voice. So it would make sense that one of the first thing to go is those instrumental introductions, just because it postpones the moment before you hear the voice.
One of the biggest things you found in your study was a decrease in the length of time in a song before the vocals start. In the Whitney Houston song we heard a few minutes ago, it was 40 seconds of instrumental intro before you hear Whitney Houston. Let's contrast that with this Taylor Swift song from 2015.
Nice to meet
Okay, so that was about 5 seconds, and that's pretty typical.
That's pretty typical. So what I've observed is that in the mid-80s, where I started to collecting data, the typical introduction would be something like 22 seconds or something like that. And when we get to the 2015, where the data collection ended, the typical intro was about 5 seconds. Now, to put this another way, that's a 78% decrease. That's a big difference. I was expecting an effect. I was not expecting an effect this big. But in hindsight, this makes sense because, again, the voice is one of the most attention-grabbing thing we have.
But this is pop music, right?
Yes.
There are a lot of other genres out there. Have you seen, I mean, even anecdotally, any similar changes in across genres?
So I haven't looked at other genres, but you make a very good argument. So imagine that you were composing music that is not meant to be top 40 dance music or whatever. So maybe you're composing music for studying or things like that. The theory would predict that we should not see an effect like that because the goal in this case is not to grab your attention. Maybe it's to have some sort of background music. Similarly, you would expect that bands whose primary way of reaching their audience is not online streaming might not be affected that much. So again, I don't have any data, but if the theory is correct, maybe we can predict that those indie bands that are really relying on LPs, right, to promote their music, so they're still releasing vinyls and their fans are really into vinyls, we should expect that they're not as susceptible to follow this attention economy theory than those top 40 artists like Taylor Swift, for example.
We are talking about how music is changing when it comes to streaming because the long instrumental intros don't catch your ear. You may or may not realize this, but my guest, Hubert Lavalle-Govan, is a doctoral student of music theory at Ohio State, and he studied this. He analyzed top 10 singles from 1986 to 2015 for the project. If you have a question or comment for Hubert, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Your study looked at four other parameters in the songs.
That's
correct. What were they? How did you choose them?
So the other parameters we looked at were the number of words in title, the tempo of a song, and the time before the hook appears. So the first thing we looked at was the number of words in title, which might seem a little bit counterintuitive at first, right? The idea came from there was this blog post on Billboard magazine, and they were mentioning they were noticing how those one-word wonder, that's the expression they were using. So those hit songs that have this very, very short title. And I thought that was a very interesting feature, and I was wondering, how does this fit the attention economy theory? And I think one way to make sense of this is to understand this sort of double nature of pop music. So we tend to think of pop music as a cultural product that artists are releasing, and this obviously makes a lot of sense. But I think in an attention economy theory, we also want to think of pop music as advertisement for the artist, right? So when you're releasing a song on Spotify, you don't make a lot of money from plays off of Spotify, but hopefully you get exposure. Maybe you sell more albums. Maybe people come see your concerts. Maybe you get invited to, the Jimmy Fallon show or something like that, which is all interesting. So once you start to think as music as advertisement for the artist, then something like having a short title makes a lot of sense because that's just more memorable. It's just easier to remember. It's your product and you want people to remember it. So this is one of the things we looked at. And what we've observed is that the words of top 10 hits has also become shorter. So we went from roughly three words to two words within 30 years or so.
Like, can you give me some examples?
So
I'm drawing a blank right now.
So the example, we opened the show with How Will I Know by Whitney Houston, right? So four words in title. And then we can think of something like Pharrell Williams' 2014 hit Happy, for example, which is this one-word thing that is very catchy, very easy to remember. Another example would be something like Maroon 5 Sugar, for example. This is something that's very short, easy to remember, easy to stick with you.
Okay.
So other things we've noticed was an increase in tempo. So we also know that tempo increases arousal. And we know that increased arousal links to a better encoding in your memory. So we know this from research in psychology and in advertisement. So again, the theory would be that if your tempo is slightly faster, your body's slightly more aroused, and things get stickier with your brain. So they're more likely to stay with you. And then the last thing we looked at was how long does it take before the hook comes in, right? So this is a bit.
And the
more
hook being the refrain or.
Exactly. So this is a bit of a complicated way to define. So one easy way to do it, which is not perfect, but it is at least objective, is to use the title of the song as being the hook. So most of the time, the title of the song is used in the either the refrain or the chorus of the song. And that's a really easy thing to do. I can just listen to the song and whenever the title is mentioned, like write that down in my.
Okay.
So that's the way we looked at. And again, we've seen a decrease in the time, how long it takes before the title of a song is mentioned. So we went from 60 seconds in the 80s to something like 49 seconds by 2015. So this is not as dramatic, but it's still something like an 18% decrease or something
and
like that.
So there's a change, but you mentioned earlier you used the phrase conscious or unconscious. You're not sure if artists are actually writing it that way, or even more to the point, producers are producing it that way. Because they certainly can tinker with whatever an artist has written.
Exactly. So I don't have any insights on whatever is happening in the Columbia studio or Sony studio. Mm-hmm. So we can see it both ways. So it's very possible that an artist is coming in and they have a very long title and a producer suggests to shorten the title. And that's probably happening to some extent. It's also possible that people do it unconsciously, as in a little bit like an evolutionary process to adapt yourself to your environment. So it's possible that as the environment is becoming more competitive with something like Spotify, the songs that tend to make it to the top 10 hits, to make it to Billboard magazines, are the songs that follow those attention economy principles. And if those songs make it as hits, it inspires other people to compose this way, either consciously or not. And then those songs become hits. And then we keep going to this sort of circling effect. So it's possible that to think of it as an evolutionary process that are just adaptive to the really, really competitive environment that is online streaming.
Bob in New Albany, you're on the air with Hubert Lavella-Govan. He's a doctoral student at OSU. Hi, Bob.
Hey, great to talk to you this morning.
Thank you.
I was going to ask one question, but first I wanted to make a comment how timely this show was, because Saturday Night Live had a hilarious sketch, which they called the Big Fat Hook. And there was some Civil War guys sitting around the fire and started singing an old Civil War song. And then Jimmy Fallon jumps up and he starts doing a real jazzy hook. So the Big Fat Hook is what they were calling it. Anyway,
okay.
Some of the most memorable songs that I have, Hey Jude, Stairway to Heaven.
Layla. I mean, my gosh, what would Layla be without the intro?
Yeah, and Hotel California.
Uh-huh.
And as soon as those start, everybody's attention just absolutely riveted on those. But I'm asking if you ran across any songs that are downloaded that fall into that category. Are most of the downloads all this new stuff? And the second thing, what's the correlation between the ages of people who are using Spotify and the ages that the music relates to? I'll listen on the radio. Thanks.
Okay, Bob. Thanks.
Thanks for your question, Bob. This is a very good point. So one thing to keep in mind is this is not a magic formula to get a hit. Okay, it's more of a generic trend of all other things being equal, those songs are more likely to be successful. And you're very right. There are many songs that don't follow any of those principles that still get a lot of airplay. a really good example is Gautier's Somebody That I Used to Know from 2012, I believe. And this song, in every way possible, is rejecting all those attention economy principles. And it was a huge hit. It was very, very big. So I'm really glad you brought that up. This is a very important point. This is not a magic formula. It's something that we sort of see, but you still need to have a really good song, and you can still write a very good song without following any of those principles. It's more of a global trend that we're seeing.
Do you know if artists and producers are putting different versions on Spotify and Pandora and iTunes than you can get if you get the album or the CD?
I'm not that familiar. I think this is a practice that is slowly dying, but I don't have any number on this.
Of radio edit or something like that.
So the second part of the question was about the age of the people on Spotify.
Right.
Again, I don't have any data, but that's also a very good point. So there's this thing in psychology that is called the reminiscence bump for music. And it reflects the fact that most people make their musical preferences or solidify their musical interests in their teens. And we see that those years are really important for your musical identity. So whatever music you were listening between, I don't know, 12 and 25 maybe or something like that, are music that are just going to stick with you in a long, long time. So people who are in their 40s, 50s, 60s tend to go back again to those songs. And even more interestingly, this reminiscence bump also goes to your children. So your children are going to have their own reminiscence bump. And then if you look back, there's going to have a smaller bump that matches their parents, probably because this music was played at home when the child were the child was younger. So again, the reminiscence bump is probably more important than the attention economy principle. So I cannot emphasize this enough. This is not a magic formula. This is not the way to write your next hit. It's just something that's happening based on the environment that people are participating in or releasing their music in.
Hubert, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Anne. It was a lot of fun.
Hubert Lavalle-Govan, he's a doctoral student in music theory at Ohio State University. He analyzed top 10 singles from 1986 to 2015 for his project to decide maybe what were some common themes in how those songs were written. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last year, the hacking group The Shadow Brothers began leaking troves of highly classified data from the National Security Agency. For a time, the leak slowed as the endeavor wasn't as profitable as they had hoped. Last week, the Shadow Brothers released more data, however, including NSA hacking tools and apparent evidence that the NSA had infiltrated the Middle East banking system. Nicole Perlroth has covered the story for The New York Times. You can check it out at the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Nicole Perlroth joins us now. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Shadow Brothers emerged last August. I read reference to them as an elite hacking group. What's known about them?
So it's actually the Shadow Brokers.
Shadow Brokers. Yep. It's right there in front of me. It's Shadow Brokers.
Okay.
Sorry.
They're a mystery. We don't know exactly who they are. They could be brothers. So they emerged actually shortly before the election, right after, I believe, the Obama administration had announced that the Russians were responsible for the DNC hacks. And you saw this mysterious group called the Shadow Brokers come out and release a pretty large trove of NSA hacking tools. At the time, they said they were doing so because they were upset with some of the recent policies, and they claimed to be an insider at the NSA who were coming out and releasing these tools because of concerns over privacy and civil liberties. And we really didn't know who they were, but the tools that they had released were pretty damaging, and it was clear that whoever they were, they had pretty deep access to the NSA's trove of hacking tools. Since then, there's been an arrest at the NSA of a former contractor from Booz Allen, Hal Martin, who some believed was actually responsible for the leaks and had been stockpiling some of the information about the NSA's hacking tools at his home in Maryland. But while he was in prison, there continued to be these leaks. So since then, the timing of this points more to a second theory, which is that this is actually Russia sending a warning shot that whatever the White House planned to do in retaliation for the Russian election hacks, Russia had somehow managed to do some hacking of its own and had access to a lot of the NSA tools that the NSA might use in some kind of counterattack. And one of the things that points to Russia also is that the timing of the latest release came after the strikes in Syria, which we know Russia was not too pleased about. And along with the latest leaks of NSA hacking tools, they posted a huge memo online that basically said, you know, we're releasing these because we're upset with President Trump's policies. He's forgotten his base. And among the laundry list of things they were upset about, they listed the attack in Syria. But the memo was written in some pretty broken English. So at this point, we think that they might be some sort of Russian hacking group pretending to be Americans. But what's really disconcerting is just how damaging the leaks have been.
The shadow broker's plan was to release the NSA data for profit, but that didn't work out. How do we know the plan was to release it for profit?
That's right. So originally, after they posted the first series of leaks, they said that they were going to be putting up the rest of the stolen data for sale for Bitcoin. And there was some ridiculous amount of Bitcoin that they were asking for this data in the hundreds of millions of dollars. No one came forward to purchase the stolen trove. And so they said that because of that, they were just going to continue to dump some of this data online.
You said that they've arrested the former contractor. How much access do contractors have to these kinds of NSA data?
Well, you just have to remember Edward Snowden to remember just how much access a contractor can have to the NSA's hacking tools. What was a little bit more alarming about this case was just how deep into the NSA's system these tools had gotten. So we don't know whether these tools are something that contractors would have even had access to. We just know that someone was able to access these. And, you know, it could have been a Russian hacking operation. It could have been some sort of insider situation. We really don't know. There's just not a lot known. All that's known at this point is that this is a very, very damaging leak for the NSA. These are tools that can take years to develop or, can be bought and sold on a black market for millions of dollars. But the tools that we've seen are things that could potentially spy on all Microsoft Windows users. People have called some of these NSA hacking tools God's view.
I'm sorry, called them what?
Basically, it's as if you're sort of a god. You can see into anyone's computer that's using these tools. Now, Microsoft has since patched some of the holes that were used in these hacking exploits. But for a long time, if you had access to these exploits and these vulnerabilities, you could basically get into anyone's computer that used these versions of Microsoft Windows that the NSA was hacking, and the user would have no idea.
So is it possible that malicious hackers have used those hacking tools that were provided by the shadow brokers?
We don't know. You assume that if Russia, if this is indeed a group of Russian hackers who's had access to these NSA troves for a while, that they might have been able to use some of these tools themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it's hard to know until these things have been patched. We really don't know who's been using them because they've been using a completely unknown inroad into these systems that we just didn't know about before and we had no way of tracking.
The recent leak it reveals evidence that the NSA had infiltrated a Middle East banking system. Can you tell us what's known about that?
Sure. So there was a number of documents that were released in the latest data dump by the shadow brokers that included a lot of mention of a SWIFT service bureau. Now, SWIFT is the system that allows banks to send messages and conduct transactions around the world. And one of these service bureaus that was mentioned in the NSA documents called eSNIPS. It's the largest such SWIFT service bureau in the Middle East. And if you believe that these documents are authentic, it appears that the NSA was using its access to eSNIPS to monitor the transactions of people who belong to all its clients, which include all the major Middle Eastern banks, many of which are in some of our allied countries, such as Kuwait. There are banks listed in Qatar, in the United Arab Emirates, in the Palestinian territories, pretty much all over the Middle East. And it looks like the NSA was using eSNIPS as a conduit to monitor some of these transactions at these banks. Now, this is not something that they were doing for any kind of profit.
Mm-hmm.
If this had been a group of cyber criminals, they would have used that access to transfer funds to their own accounts. But it looks like what they were doing was to follow the money and track the transactions of foreign targets that they were monitoring, potentially terrorists and government officials that they wanted to keep track of.
The leaks also make a connection between the NSA and the Stuxnet virus that destroyed the Iranian centrifuges. What's the story there?
That's right. So there are some similarities in the code that was released to some of the code that was used in Stuxnet, which is the computer virus that the United States and Israel used on the Natanz nuclear facility in Iran to destroy thousands of centrifuges. And until now, there's been quite a bit of reporting, including from my colleague at the time, David Sanger, that Stuxnet was indeed the work of a joint effort between the United States and Israel. But this would be the first time in the latest leak that we actually have access to NSA code that bears striking similarities to the code that was used in the Stuxnet attack and suggests that yes, the NSA did, in fact, pull off that attack.
You know, you made the point about as far as who the shadow brokers are or where they're from. You refer to the syntax, of the writing of the messages that they've sent as being kind of in a bad English, broken English kind of a way. Couldn't that be that we've become so familiar with that broken English thing that somebody's putting it out there like that to throw them off?
Yeah, there's a lot here that could potentially be what they call a false flag. You know, the first thing is actually the fact that they put the data up for auction for Bitcoins. Mm-hmm. That's not something a nation state would usually do. The second thing is that the letter is so written in such obviously broken English, you would think that if a nation state was doing this, they would at least get someone who is fluent in English to write these letters. So there's a lot here. We cannot say definitively one way or the other, this is Russia or this is an NSA insider trying to throw people off. It's pretty mysterious. The one thing that I will say, though, is that when it comes to cyber arsenals or cyber armies, the U.S. is really fighting a pretty asymmetrical war. Now, in China relies on its own army hackers, but it also relies on a large group of outside contractors, people who have day jobs at, say, Tencent during the day, and then at night are told or paid to use their skills to hack Chinese targets. In Russia, the situation is even more widespread. There are definitely FSU FSB and GRU divisions who are charged with hacking foreign targets. But there is also a large group of outside contractors in Russia, perhaps many, many more than we have here in the United States, with the skills that the government can tap to do some of these operations. In the U.S., we just have the Pentagon Cyber Command. The intelligence communities don't really rely on random engineers at Google to do their bidding. So it's not exactly clear that this could be the work of one government agency or a group of outsiders who've been told to make this look like someone else. We really just don't know. And that's really the hardest part about what they call attribution is it can take years to find out who actually was behind some of these hacks.
And by then, who knows? Or in any case, a lot of people don't even care. And as far as the arrest goes, how did they come to that arrest in the first place? How do they track something like that?
I believe that they just used their own internal tracking, the same that they, after Edward Snowden basically made off with thousands of classified documents, Booz Allen installed a number of new insider employee monitoring and tracking systems. And I think the first shadow broker's leak tipped off a lot of alarm to go back and see if there had been any kind of contractor access to the NSA's trove of hacking tools. And I believe that they found that this one contractor in Maryland, Hal Martin, had allegedly accessed some of these tools. And when they raided his home, they found that allegedly he'd been stockpiling some of these tools at his home.
When you talk about tools, what are you talking about?
So tools, NSA hacking tools, are basically just libraries of vulnerabilities in commonly used systems like Microsoft Windows or Gmail or the iPhone that can be weaponized by an intelligence agency to infiltrate a system and do what they want. So in this case, the NSA appeared to be using vulnerabilities in Microsoft Windows to access the Middle Eastern SWIFT system we were talking about earlier. This is something that the intelligence agencies have been doing for decades. They are constantly looking for holes in commonly used systems that can be exploited for espionage, or in the case of Stuxnet, to drop a cyber weapon that can destroy centrifuges. And it's interesting because it puts the technology companies in a pretty awkward place. I mean, in this case, Microsoft had to wake up one day and find out that the NSA had been using vulnerabilities in its system that the government had not disclosed to it until, we believe, fairly recently, to spy on several of its users And it usually forces teams of Microsoft into a war room for a three-day weekend where they're just eating pizza and drinking Red Bull and trying to patch these vulnerabilities as quickly as they can. The most prominent of these sort of conflicts of interest was the one you saw debated pretty heavily last year when the FBI was asking Apple to provide it with a vulnerability or backdoor to get into one of the iPhones used by the shooters in the San Bernardino attacks. And you know, you saw Apple's response in that case was no.
Mm-hmm.
But you also saw Tim Cook say, you know, we're sure that the intelligence agencies have plenty of other ways to
right.
get this information. And so what they were sort of alluding to with a wink-wink was the fact that the NSA has these longstanding, heavily resourced programs of just trying to find any which way they can into these devices that they use for espionage.
And has Microsoft made any public statements about this?
Yes, they have. They and this in itself is a mystery. So, you know, most of the tools that were released were mostly damaging for Microsoft. I believe there were some Cisco firewall vulnerabilities mentioned in there too, but the vast majority of the tools relied on flaws in Microsoft Windows. And when the leaks first came out, you saw a lot of hype coming out from people like Edward Snowden. He said, you know, this is egregious. This is not a drill. This is the clearest case we have that the NSA is leaving us all wide open to these attacks. And then it turned out that Microsoft actually put out a blog post that said, actually, we'd patched all the holes that were mentioned in these releases in the last few updates of our software. And what's interesting about that is Microsoft usually credits the people either inside Microsoft or outside Microsoft to point out these flaws in their system. In this case, Microsoft didn't say who had told them about the flaws in their system. So the reigning theory here is that the NSA knew these tools had been stolen, that there was a possibility that they would be released, and so they told Microsoft in some way, shape, or form, anonymously, that they needed to patch these holes.
Nicole Perlroth, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about this. I appreciate it.
Thanks. It's a complicated story. Thanks for showing some interest in it.
Absolutely. Nicole Perlroth, cybersecurity reporter for the New York Times, will post a link to her story about the shadow brokers' release of NSA data for profit and maybe not so much profit and what else they've done with it. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Last week, Burger King made a whopper of a mistake when the company aired a television commercial crafted to trigger Google Home.
You're watching a 15-second Burger King ad, which is unfortunately not enough time to explain all the fresh ingredients in the Whopper sandwich. But I got an idea. Okay, Google, what is the Whopper burger?
Lots of Google Home users felt the ad was an invasion, and Google quickly disabled the voice command feature so that it would not work with the commercial. Joining us now to talk about that and other tech news, contributing editor to AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thanks.
So this was on TV, and when it says that Google quickly disabled the voice command feature so that it wouldn't work with the commercial, how did they do that?
Well, it was actually kind of a multi-stage process because over the span of 45 minutes, we actually got several different answers from, you know, if you asked Google Home what the Whopper burger was. The initial attempt here was you know, kind of a well-placed article from Burger King so that the information that Burger King wanted to share was, like, right there to be answered. And that only worked for about 10 minutes, and then it quickly was redirected to Wikipedia as a Wikipedia answer for what is the Whopper burger, and basically the Whopper page on Wikipedia was just kind of read off. But then, you know, Wikipedia is something that can be edited by just about anybody, and so we very very quickly that the answer changed from something that was polite to something that was very impolite. For the ingredients of this sandwich. And so, you know, over the course of this kind of 45-minute period, there were a couple of changes made, and eventually Google just made it so that when that question was heard, Google Home just didn't respond at all.
Now, were these human beings responding to this? In other words, at Google, were they people or were they bots of some type?
No, even, you know, this was the changes that were made here, you know, had to have been made by people. This is the kind of thing that you see. And that was how this was able to work in the first place was, you know, it's all initially, driven by Google's, you know, computer services mm-hmm. where, you know, the best answer very much in the same way when you search for something just on Google.com. The best answer according to Google's robots will float to the top and appear in, you know, some kind of card design. And those answers are usually what you will hear if you ask Google Home the same question that you would type into search.
Is this the first time a company has used the voice feature on a home assistant device to advertise a product like this?
I think this is the first time it has happened on this scale. There have been examples that have been recorded and kind of shown to Google, quietly. To kind of demonstrate that this system could potentially be easy to manipulate, depending on how accurate the search was or how easily you could convince someone to perform, a basic search. And it's certainly not a new thing to have commercials on a television accidentally trigger, a voice service. This has happened with Amazon's Alexa on several occasions. It's happened with the Microsoft Xbox Kinect service for years. So the idea of waking up this kind of automated system is not a new idea in and of itself, but this is the first time I think that it was done so effectively and so quickly.
It was calculated, and they had to calculate in that equation that there were enough people listening that have that feature that Google Home to make it worth it, right?
Well, it's an important thing that, this was not just Google Home. That same, kind of OK Google response is now built into most Android phones.
Okay.
For that feature. So, not every Android phone will wake up and react upon hearing that request. And in fact, most Android phones, the microphones are tuned in such a way that you have to be very kind of particular about how you say something to your phone. So it did not work on every Android phone, but it worked on a lot of Android phones, and it was kind of a guarantee that it was going to work on every Google Home.
Now, I started this out saying that Burger King made a Whopper of a mistake. Was it? I mean, obviously they did it on purpose. Was it bad advertising? I mean, was it negative? Did it do them harm?
I don't think it did them harm. I think Google, had the more negative, potential here because there's a lot that Google has to do every time a product like this is released
right.
to kind of justify its existence in other industries. So Google as a search company and as an email company, there's a lot of advertising that goes into those products. And so a huge concern anytime something like Google Home or the acquisition of the Nest thermostat, there's always this kind of lingering concern that ads are going to eventually make their way to those products. And so Google kind of has to work overtime to ensure people that those things aren't going to happen. And this was a pretty significant misstep for Google to not have a way to deal with it.
So what is your prediction as far as more brands trying something like that? What do you see in the future when it comes to this kind of advertising?
I don't think it's something we're going to see on a frequent basis. I think it's the kind of thing that's it worked this time for Burger King because it was kind of a shock mm-hmm. To see that it was effective in the first place. But know, anytime there's a new technology like this, it's really, especially with how incredibly built up we see now the social presences for so many large brands across like Facebook and Twitter and things like that. You know, these teams are given kind of leeway to do exciting things like this to try and you know, build up a lot of excitement. And so the core idea where you know, you're trying to get a whole bunch of attention by doing something that's kind of shocking, I don't think is going away anytime soon. But I don't think that we're going to see a rush of, you know, other companies trying to trip up Google Home.
Let's talk about travel. For those people who like to travel with their gadgets, there's a new backpack from Tilt that might fit the bill. Is that right? Tilt?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
It's called the Tilt Energy Pro.
Yeah, the Tilt Energy Pro. I owned the predecessor to this backpack for a long time because it was one of the first backpacks that was that had a massive battery sewn into the bag that would allow that was acceptable through airport security. You know, it was certified to travel through airport security. And so for me, traveling on a regular basis means having stuff that is charging while I'm traveling. And so it was a big deal to have, but it was also just a very well-made backpack. It was sturdy and you know, big enough to hold my laptop and you know, all of my camera gear and things like that for when I travel. And it became a backpack that I just recommended to everyone. But over the last year, the battery capacity is kind of low compared to what you can get from batteries that you can just stuff in a regular backpack for, you know, $30 and $40. And, you know, the ports that were on that particular battery only supported you know, phones that were out 5 years ago now. So you didn't have things like fast charging or USB Type-C or anything like that. This new backpack, the Energy Pro, is a big update to that. It contains a much more capable battery, a much larger battery that includes both, you know, quick charge ports for rapidly charging things, as well as USB Type-C ports for charging, you know, not only newer technology for mobile devices, but also you know, laptops and tablets that support that tech can be charged through this as well.
What about the combustibility of batteries? Is that an issue with this new one?
You know, this goes under the same testing that any large battery that enters the U.S. the way that it is supposed to is tested. And like its predecessor, it's been approved for you know, airplane travel you know, has the same kind of rapidly open compartment for laptops that makes it easy to go through airport security. So I don't suspect that it will be a problem, you know, due to the testing that goes into those kind of things.
And how much will it set me back?
This is not an inexpensive backpack, very much like its predecessor. You're going to find this right now only on the Tilt website for
$150. $150 on the Tilt website. Let's see. We only have about a minute left, so I don't know if there's any much more time, but are you getting one to replace your old Tilt?
I will probably get one closer to the end of summer to replace my old Tilt, just because I'm not going anywhere for a while.
Okay, and is this good for, you know, travelers who are going long distances? Does it matter if they're going overseas, anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a backpack that you can take anywhere. It's very easily something that you could wear, you know, every day, unless you don't like, you know, kind of a thicker backpack, because it's got a lot of padding to it to keep your gear safe. But if you travel with more than just your phone on a regular basis, you know, especially if you have like a real camera or a tablet or a laptop, this is a great option.
All right, good to know. Russell Holley, thank you so much for your time today, as usual.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Holley, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.